today, why Bitcoin might not be the future of money after all. Alex Hearn, you're The Guardian's UK technology editor. How long have you been reporting on Bitcoin?
Having looked back at old clippings, which even predate me joining The Guardian, it looks like it's 7 years now. I first wrote about Bitcoin in 2013. When I joined The Guardian later in that year, my first front page was actually a story about Bitcoin. I had tracked down a Welsh man who realized that he'd thrown away a hard drive that held on it the password to 7,500 Bitcoin.
Somewhere under all this rubbish in this huge public landfill site lies $7.5 million worth of Bitcoins. It's on a computer hard drive belonging to this man.
Effectively, he was one of the very first people to get involved with this project, I suppose, in the world. And he didn't even buy this Bitcoin. He mined it. He used his computer to help do the sums that make the Bitcoin network work. And in return was given Bitcoin. And then kind of fell off, stopped thinking about it. Until in 2013, at the height of Bitcoin's, I want to say, second boom, he remembered that he'd had this laptop.
Any hesitation, any moments before you chucked it in with the boxes and the bottles to bring down?
As soon as I put it in the bin at home, I had a second thought, you know, in the back of my mind. You know, you've never thrown a hard drive out before. Why start now?
And then he remembered that he'd cleared out this laptop and he'd thrown the hard drive away, and it was sitting and still is sitting somewhere in Newport's municipal dump.
Oh, no.
But when I arrived yesterday, they basically told me that anything that goes into the household scrap bin is compressed and buried.
At the time, that was worth £4.5 million. Today, it would be worth £225 million.
I just wish I could go back in time and not throw that drive away.
Last week, James Howes offered Newport Council a quarter of that estimated £225 million fortune that he might have in Bitcoin if they help him dig it out of the landfill site. He could be onto something. In the past few months, the value of the digital currency has soared.
No banks, no fees, no inflation. These are the potential perks of this thing called Bitcoin.
This is a proxy for the mistrust individuals have of central bankers.
And it's zooming in value lately. Just unbelievable how much this has taken off.
But the UK finance regulator, the FCA, has warned against investing in cryptocurrencies, saying that you could risk losing all your money. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, what is Bitcoin and is it a scam? Alex, I'm going to be completely honest here. I don't really understand Bitcoin. I'm aware it's been around for quite a long time. I've been told to invest in it multiple times, and I've heard stories like the one you've just told me about the man in Newport, but I really don't get it. What is Bitcoin?
What is Bitcoin? There's a lot of confusion out there, but it's actually really simple.
Today, we're going to start from scratch and answer the third most searched term on Google today. What is Bitcoin?
I'm going to firstly steal one of my favorite pithy descriptions of it ever, which was tweeted out a few years back. Imagine if leaving your car idling solved Sudokus that you could then trade for heroin.
Oh, great. I understand it now. Thank you.
Bitcoin is an attempt to create a decentralized currency. As a theoretical problem, that is really hard. And before about 2000, I think many people would have said it was impossible, because to have a currency, you need to have a few things. You need to have scarcity. It can't be something that you can just create out of thin air. You need to have universal agreement that it is in fact a currency, and you need to have the ability to trade it. A digital currency typically lacked one of those things. Most often it lacked scarcity. You can copy files using a computer. You can make an identical copy of any digital file at any point. One of the ways that that problem was solved, and you know, this goes back to something like PayPal in the 90s, was just to have a central registry that apportioned the currency across people. You know, it would say, Alex, you have £100 in your PayPal account, Rachel has £50. But that was just handing control of this digital currency over to a centralized body. And for many people, particularly these libertarian thinkers, that was unacceptable. So Bitcoin was this way of creating a true decentralized digital currency. And the way it does that, and I'm really, really oversimplifying, of course, is it allows for individuals on the Bitcoin network to use computing power to vote on whether or not they think a particular transaction is legitimate or not. All they have to do is burn processing cycles, spend their computer power to do otherwise useless mathematics just to show that they've done those maths. And then they get effectively a vote that says, yeah, all of these transactions that come through are legitimate and we should update our collectively held records as to who owns what in proportion to what we've heard. That process called mining is really important to Bitcoin because it means that even if you went out and bought 500,000 computers and tried to swamp the Bitcoin network with fake transactions that say, I, Alex, I own all of the Bitcoin now, it would be prohibitively expensive to do it because you would have to spend, you know, supercomputers upon supercomputers worth of power lying to overcome all of the other people who were telling the truth. It's confusing and complicated, but the effective outcome of it is that electricity goes in one end of the Bitcoin network and a consensus agreement about who owns what Bitcoin comes out the other end.
Okay, so I understand that it's a kind of collective bank, as it were, in this sense. But how does an individual actually access Bitcoin? Like, if I want to get a Bitcoin, how do I do that? And do I need actual money to get Bitcoin?
Basically, the way you will get Bitcoin is you will download or install a Bitcoin wallet, which is a piece of software that allows you to speak to that global network. And then you'll go to a Bitcoin exchange that lets you exchange real money for internet money. And then the whole network will be updated and you will then possess that Bitcoin. In theory, you can get Bitcoin without spending money. That's the process of mining.
Okay, so this is my mining farm at my apartment. Now I have 6 mining rigs here, as you can see, and 4 of them is in this hydroponic tent. Now I do want to mention that I do have a fixed electricity cost here.
In practice, in 2021, with the scale of the Bitcoin network, no individual is really likely to be able to provide enough processing power into the network that they'll get Bitcoin back out in return. It's a phenomenally expensive way of doing things. There is a fundamental economic truth underpinning it, which is that mining will lose you money unless you can get electricity that costs less than the value of the Bitcoin you get in return. That tends to mean that professional miners congregate in a few ultimately quite physical locations, areas that have very cheap electricity because they have access to, say, geothermal power or hydroelectric power.
Why has a chilly island in the North Atlantic become a crucial frontier in the occult high-stakes world of cryptocurrency mining?
There's a lot of Bitcoin miners in Iceland, for instance, because not only is electricity cheap, but cooling is very cheap. Running these computers all day produces heat, and if you're Iceland, it's easy enough to get rid of that excess heat. You just carry on being in Iceland. There is also a second hotspot, which is people who can somehow steal electricity. That could be as simple as running a cable from your neighbor's house and putting the electricity on their meter, to something as complex as a type of malware called a coin miner, which will install itself on the computers of victims and mine Bitcoin on their computers without them knowing it. The network as a whole uses an astronomical amount of computing power. The electricity drawn by the Bitcoin network is somewhere around the electricity drawn by the country of Ireland.
Whoa.
It is inherently wasteful. There is no such thing as a low energy version of Bitcoin, because burning the processing power is how the Bitcoin network works. It's an environmental disaster, just aside from anything else about this currency.
Who came up with the idea for Bitcoin?
A pseudonymous programmer who went by the name of Satoshi Nakamoto. To this day, we still don't actually know who they are. One person has come forward and said that he is Satoshi Nakamoto, an Anglo-Australian computer scientist called Craig Wright, who was first accidentally unmasked as Satoshi Nakamoto and then accepted the unmasking and claimed that he was indeed Satoshi. There's some circumstantial evidence that suggests that Wright may be telling the truth, but there's been clouds over his claim to that title ever since he first stepped forward because of the extremely confusing way in which he claimed to be Satoshi Nakamoto.
My name's Craig Wright, and I'm about to demonstrate a signing of a message with the public key that is associated with the first transaction ever done on Bitcoin.
And there is an unarguable way that any person could prove that they are the person who created Bitcoin, and that is by moving the very first Bitcoin that was ever created into their personal wallet. Craig Wright, when he set out to prove to be Satoshi Nakamoto, didn't do that. And we have a few other possible candidates, some of whom have said they're not him, some of whom are dead.
What you're saying, Alex, is that we're awaiting Bitcoin's sword in the stone moment where someone will step forward and be able to access that password and that first Bitcoin, and then we'll know.
But we may never have that moment, because to come forward as Satoshi Nakamoto, you would be revealing yourself as someone with access to billions upon billions of pounds of Bitcoin that could be taken from you simply by extracting a single password from you, and that you demonstrably have not used to buy any real goods or services. Those Bitcoin are still in the account, they haven't been spent, and that means you probably don't have a billionaire's security team.
If I were able to get hold of some Bitcoin, Alex, what can I actually do with it?
The first thing that you can do, as shown by tales like James Howell's, is lose it. The next thing you could do, the next most popular thing really for owners of Bitcoin, is just hold on to it. Most people, I think, who are buying Bitcoin today are buying it as an investment, as a gamble that the Bitcoin will be worth more when they sell it than it was when they bought it. The two next most prominent uses of Bitcoin are drug dealing and ransomware.
And federal prosecutors have officially charged two Bitcoin entrepreneurs with using the virtual currency to launder $1 million from drug trafficking on the underground website Silk Road.
Because Bitcoin exists purely digitally, and because it doesn't have any central register, either a central body authorizing who gets to hold Bitcoin or any sort of requirement to sign up for an account, to send a scan of your passport to prove who you are, Bitcoin suddenly became very, very useful for crime. Hackney Borough Council is still reeling from the effects of a ransomware attack last October, when its entire systems were encrypted. It was locked out of anything digital for days on end, and it was asked for a very large ransom. And that money will have been demanded in Bitcoin or an equivalent cryptocurrency. Obviously, it's not great PR for Bitcoin that those two uses are so widely known. And it is worth saying that there are tons of legitimate uses of Bitcoin as well.
And some businesses accept payment in Bitcoin too, like this soup restaurant.
There is an advantage, and that's lower transaction fees.
If you there are the plenty of sites online that will allow you to spend Bitcoin at the checkout. There are companies that will allow you to load Bitcoin onto a Visa debit card and spend it just as though it were normal money. The problem is that for a lot of those legitimate uses, it's not entirely clear where the advantage for Bitcoin comes. Generally, you need some other external motivation to end up using Bitcoin as a normal payment system. Perhaps you have hundreds of millions of pounds of Bitcoin and can't be asked to cash it out. Perhaps you politically believe in the currency for its decentralized nature and you want to encourage merchants to take it. Or perhaps you're just experimenting.
Right. So you're saying there's not a big advantage to using Bitcoin for legal means, whereas there is for illegal ones. But I was thinking earlier about an episode of Today in Focus we made a few months ago about the NSARS protest movement in Nigeria, which took donations in Bitcoin to protect it from the government. Are there other examples like this?
One of the most famous specific examples is actually WikiLeaks. In 2010, following the Cablegate revelations, the story that The Guardian worked on with WikiLeaks about a huge tranche of diplomatic cables that had been leaked and uncovered American activity around the world, the US State Department put pressure on private companies that provided payment services to WikiLeaks to suspend those services. Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal all froze the ability to donate money to WikiLeaks using their networks. After that, WikiLeaks became probably the highest profile organization to begin accepting donations in Bitcoin. This was 2010, way before most people had heard of the currency. But it did work. And it has carried on to this day, accepting donations to fund its work in cryptocurrency. That, I think, for many is the archetypal example of the sort of freedom that having a decentralized cryptocurrency enables. I will probably be chalked up as anti-Bitcoin when I say that the fundamental thing that is unlocked by Bitcoin is an availability of a digital currency that you can use for crime. That sounds quite negative. But the thing is, there's a lot of countries in the world, and not everything that is a crime in those countries is bad. Not all laws are just. I personally think in a democratic liberal nation like the UK, the overlap of what it is illegal to spend money on and what it is immoral to spend money on is pretty close. There are, by and large, fewer reasons, I think, for needing the ability to break the law with currency in the UK than in other countries.
Coming up, why the UK's financial regulator has issued a warning about investing in Bitcoin. Alex, we're talking about Bitcoin now because its value is higher than it's ever been.
Bitcoin had a new record high today, above 20,000 once again, and it looks like we're
Christmas Eve to Sunday, it rose over 20%, breaching that 28,000. I mean, can this actually last?
Bitcoin broke through 38,000, then 39,000, and finally 41,000, all in about 24 hours.
Why has that happened?
The really glib answer is it's happened because more people want to buy Bitcoin than sell it for the past few months. You know, that's an economics 101 answer, because the truth is no one really knows. There are explanations that people have proposed as to why Bitcoin has gone up recently. One very popular one amongst supporters of Bitcoin itself is the idea that coronavirus led to an explosion in deficit-funded government projects. In America, you had stimulus checks that were paid for through borrowing. In the UK, you've had the furlough scheme. You've had Eat Out to Help Out. You've had the self-employed support scheme. If you are one of these radical economic thinkers who views inflation as a great beast hovering over the horizon of every Western country,
you cannot have central banks infinitely printing currency.
Then it's possible to look at that spending and go, I want to have my savings in a financial instrument that cannot be affected by inflation. I choose Bitcoin. That is an explanation. Personally, I don't buy it. Most people who've bought Bitcoin over the last 3 or 4 months bought it because they saw it was going up and they wanted to try and make money. And over the last week since it peaked, they've sold it because they saw it was going down and they wanted to make sure they didn't lose money.
But who are the people buying large quantities of it at the moment?
One of the other justifications for the explosion in the last few months is that increasingly, there are institutional buyers who are getting interested in Bitcoin. What you want, if you are, particularly if you're running something like a pension fund where you need to preserve most of your money but also try and make a profit over a long period of time, one thing that you're often looking for is something called uncorrelated returns, financial instruments that don't move in the same direction as everything else. Bitcoin moves chaotically, randomly. And that actually is quite useful for a certain type of investor. And that is, to me, a believable way that the Bitcoin price has gone up over the past year or so. If enough institutional investors put even tiny fractions of their institutional investments into this still quite young technology, then the demand explodes.
That's really interesting, because at the start of this episode, you talked about how Bitcoin was seen as this revolutionary new kind of money that was the antithesis to conventional banking. But now it feels like it's becoming something that established investors are betting on, which sounds good. But last week, the UK's Financial Conduct Authority warned cryptocurrency investors that they should be prepared to lose all their money. Why did they issue that warning, do you think?
The short answer is because it's true. There is no fundamental justification for Bitcoin's value. There is no bankruptcy process for Bitcoin. The Bitcoin system doesn't hold assets that can be auctioned off to repay investors. It simply is the value that people are prepared to offer it. And if everyone collectively goes, nah, Bitcoin's a bit 2010s, isn't it? Then you lose all your money, because who would buy your Bitcoin from you? There is a second tier to it, though. Bitcoin is still really heavily advertised as effectively a get-rich-quick scheme. It is a risky financial instrument, and perhaps that's fine. There are other risky financial instruments, but when it's sold to perhaps naive retail investors as something that other people have made millions on and you can too, that's the point where I think the FCA sees the need to step in.
Is it unusual for a financial regulator to issue a warning like this? And could they go even further?
Generally, when the FCA issues that sort of warning, it's on products which are widely agreed to be borderline scammy. Ultimately, it's not impossible to just ban Bitcoin. Or rather, it is impossible to just ban Bitcoin. And Bitcoin advocates will tell you this over and over again. Bitcoin is a code. Bitcoin is an idea. You can't ban it because there's no central authority to throw in jail. There is no way of going through every computer in the world and deleting the Bitcoin code. And the UK only enforces laws within the UK. So regardless of what Britain did, there would still be Bitcoin in Russia. There would still be Bitcoin in Somalia. But at the same time, the FCA can turn to banks and credit card companies and everyone it regulates and go, it is illegal for you to have anything to do with Bitcoin. If you send money to a Bitcoin exchange, we will treat it as though you have done money laundering. If you allow a user to deposit money that was made through the sale of Bitcoin, we will treat that as though you have engaged in money laundering. If every bank, every credit card company, every conventional payment regulator did that now, I think it would effectively end Bitcoin as a normal financial asset.
But should it be banned, though, Alex? You told us about how it was established as a currency that was decentralized and perhaps could change the world. But you've told us how also it's been used more for illegal means than perhaps for anything else. Should we do away with it?
I kind of think we should. This is a personal view. This is something that I've come to after years of following tech regulation in general. But I find it hard to look at the extent to which we are trying to regulate a company like Facebook, which, for all my problems with Facebook, is absolutely used by literally billions of people around the world. And despite that, the fringe harms caused by Facebook are sufficient that we are considering imposing swingeing regulation on it. And then to turn and look at Bitcoin and see, in my opinion, a ratio of costs to benefits that is wildly in favor of costs. The benefits of Bitcoin are, at best, a hypothetical future in which it enables forms of financial innovation that still don't exist today. And the harms of Bitcoin are very, very real, very obvious, and have bedded in over a decade and shown no signs of going away. For me, it should at least be regulated away into a laboratory experiment that gets rolled out in the UK with heavy regulation once the test bed has proven that something of value has been created, and also, frankly, has proved that the thing of value that has been created isn't a new and innovative way of breaking laws or bypassing governments. Until then, I can't see the advantage to the FCA and to, frankly, governments of allowing it to exist.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Alex Hearn. I highly recommend going to theguardian.com and reading back through his coverage of cryptocurrencies over the years, including the time he made a digital currency all of his own called Hearncoin, which didn't exactly take off. And to confirm, Hearncoin was worth what?
Given there was no transaction ever made in Hearncoin, priceless, really.
That's it for today. This episode was produced by Sam Colbert and Toby Thomas. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.